The House Committee on Revenue for February 3rd, 2012 will come to order. We have first a public hearing on House Bill 4039. We'll open that.
Christine? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4039 has a number of provisions to modify the Senior and Disabled Deferral Program. There is a requirement that it has been added to for a financial institution to notify a potential borrower of the prohibition against having a reverse mortgage and pledging the tax-deferred homestead as a security for the reverse mortgage. The measure specifies the ways in which any retroactive credit could be made to taxpayers and the procedures for doing that between the Department of Revenue and the county assessors. It just clarifies the classification of homesteads for the purposes of determining the county median real market value limit that is applied to the participants and applicants in the program. There's a requirement for Department of Revenue to certify eligibility for the deferral not less than once every 3 years, but it gives them more flexibility in administering this requirement. It also requires the department to report to interim committee regarding a claim form for the Homestead Property Tax Deferral Program for the property tax year beginning on July 1st, 2012. The amendment, the Dash 3 amendment, broadens that notification requirement to all lenders rather than just those under ORS 706-008, and also removes references to the Fair Trade Practices Act. It extends a two-year reprieve to existing program participants who have actually applied into the program and been denied for the 2011-12 tax year and retroactively pays their tax bill and allows them participation in the program. It also waives any interest that might be associated with that. And then it also allows them to continue the program for the 2012-2013 tax year as well. So essentially it's a two-year reprieve. The amendment also has a requirement that the Department of Revenue conduct a survey of participants to gather socioeconomic information about them, and the survey form will be developed and approved by the interim Legislative Assembly Revenue Committees. The revenue impact of this two-year extension for these people who were denied solely due to a reverse mortgage is $6.01 million in 2011-13, and then the additional repayments that would result from extending those payments are $850,000 in 2013-15 and $590,000 in 2015-17. So that is actually a negative revenue impact in the first biennium and then two positive revenue impacts thereafter.
Very good. Thank you very much. Let's take a panel of David Raphael, Lenore Bijan, and Darrell Lloyd. Darvell.
Hi.
Yes, sir.
My name is David Raphael, and I'm representing the Alliance of Vulnerable Homeowners, co-chair Berger and co-chair Barnhart. I'm really delighted. We just saw the proposal that you're talking about, and so I don't have prepared written remarks, but I wanted to express our gratitude and our pleasure at what the solution that you've come up with. It does not cover every critical case in our judgment of people that were caught up because of the changes last year, but it goes a long way toward doing that. And some of the most critical cases of people with reverse mortgages, I think, get a reprieve during this period, and we're thankful for you. Two things I would add. One, I would hope, and we'll work it up and share with the staff. I hope there would be opportunity to look at. There are some people in that list of you'd call them non-responders, not applicants, who were actively, they've come to our attention, who are actively discouraged from submitting an application. Otherwise, they're exactly in the same situation with a reverse mortgage. We have some suggestions about how you might be able to identify that limited number out of that group, and in fairness, we urge you to think about it. And the others offer our help to you in getting the Senate to join with you in this amendment, and if we can be of assistance in that, we think it would be very useful. So thank you for what you've done.
Thank you.
My name is Lenore Bion, and I'm also a member of the organization, the Alliance. I do want to thank you. I realize that initially you were hit with the need to either scuttle the program entirely or do something. And what you did, you did. And but as a homeowner with a reverse mortgage and a very low Social Security income, I am absolutely delighted with a two-year reprieve. However, I also know that there are a lot of people in my position, including me, who are going to spend many sleepless nights with no extra resources to depend on, wondering what's going to happen to us when those 2 years are up. And so it's not totally a fait accompli, but what you have done is great, and I thank you for it.
I'm Darvill Lloyd, chair of the Southeast District Senior Advisory Council in Portland, also representing Impact Northwest Agency, nonprofit human service agency in Portland. And I'm very pleased to see this bill. It's a tremendous relief. It of course, like the two others said, that it isn't all what we wanted, but it certainly goes a long way. And I, too, want to thank you all for bringing the property tax deferral back from practically the dead last year with zero balance. And so it looks like we've saved the program and are giving relief to 650 homeowners, I see here.
1,650,
yes. So my hat is off to all of you for bringing this on. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions, comments for this panel?
Yes, I could. You folks were all here at the hearing a few weeks ago, and you can go back to those who may not have come to this hearing. We heard them.
Thank you.
We don't have a lot of options, but we understand the pain, that particularly for folks who were blindsided by this. And thank you for coming. And
well, we will spread the word. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. John Mullen, Rick Bennett.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen here on behalf of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon Tax and Revenue Committee. We submitted testimony at the public hearing back on January 20th, and we too are here to acknowledge the good work of the committee in proposing a solution that works for many of the people that are affected. We also want to commend you for working on the solvency of the program and the long-term health of the program. And the Human Services Coalition stands ready to help in any way during the interim or going into the 2013 session about ways to improve the program. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations, AARP Oregon. Ditto. I think certainly the first panel really said it was needed. I just want to be on the record to say that we support House Bill 4039 as it's just been discussed. And again, we recognize the difficult constraints that you're working with on this. And so, frankly, I wasn't quite sure how far you were going to be able to go because of those constraints, but I think this is a very good effort, and we support it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your testimony and your good work on the bill in the past as well. Appreciate it. This is very likely to be our only public hearing on this bill. Is there anyone else here who would like to be heard on this bill today? I don't see anyone. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4039, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4037. Is that also yours? Oh, that's Chris.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4037 should look familiar. It's the annual Reconnect bill. You have in your packet some input provided by the Oregon Society on CPAs. Provides some brief summary of provisions adopted at the federal level. You also have a draft SMS and revenue impact. And the revenue impact is a minimal revenue gain or loss. And that's simply because there wasn't much done at the federal level this past year that would affect Oregon taxes directly. So by comparison to recent years, it was a relatively dull year for this bill. So.
Great. Is this the material that the CPA?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay. CPA's prepared us a landscape formatted worksheet, 3 pages long. I think they were probably correct in thinking they didn't have to take someone away from work in tax season in order to explain these items, but I commend it to the committee to review and see if there are any of the issues on it that you'd like to review further. Representative Berger.
Well, I know we don't have testimony, and I was going to speak briefly to the committee. There is a similar bill in the Senate. This one gives us another vehicle, depending on what it's more than anything else, an opportunity. This is our committee bill. We need to have it on the record, and that's kind of the expectation today.
Right. That's correct. And I have no one signed up to testify on this bill. I guess the CPAs have said it all with their 3-page handout. Is there anyone who'd like to be heard? I don't see anyone. Short public hearing.
Wait, can I say something?
Yes, please. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, CPAs are incredibly useful, offer good, insightful counsel, and are always correct.
Right.
Mr. Chair, I have to put in there, don't they say that about legislators?
No.
Yes. Did you declare a conflict of interest on that comment?
No conflict, I was right.
All right, and with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4037 and open the first public hearing on House Bill 4036. Manzin.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. Good to see everybody's healthy and back to work. Welcome back, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
House Bill 4036, you have a step as a summary that quickly describes the bill. It probably looks a little more complicated than it is. The bill basically takes an existing tax, which is the hotel motel tax, or what we call the transient lodging tax of the 1% that we impose on transient lodging, temporary housing, and extend that to the developmental disabilities providers. You have in the bill to quickly just go through this process that you have in front of you. Let me go through a quick sections. The first section of the bill basically makes the money appropriation that comes out of this tax or the revenue of this tax to DHS, and then goes to the different definitions as you would see in the first page. That is from line 14 down to 29 of who is included in those definitions. And same same thing continues until the end of the section. Section 2 basically puts the new definitions in the existing law. Section 3 allows for the residential care into the charge and the cost, and defines the provider rather than only being the provider of the transient lodging service. The provider is giving a different definition at this point. The Section 4 extends that tax while keeping the local tax or local taxes, the language of that local taxes, keep it in, and add this tax only to the state segment of the transient lodging tax. The Section 5 makes the exemptions work for the exemptions from the existing tax, adds the keeps the hospitals only being exempt from that existing tax. And Sections 6 through 10 makes those provisions and puts back all the pieces that needs to work. The Section 11 creates the two accounts. So one, you would have the existing tax that goes into the money of that transient lodging, and the second one will be for the new money. And then the rest of the sections, 14, 15, and so on, they basically go back and take out all these new provisions that we put into the law for the time when this would be repealed. And then the last few sections makes that repeal conditional on either lack of approval from the federal government for the matching amounts for Medicare and Medicaid, or the date of October 1st, 2019. And that's quickly how this bill is designed to work.
Great. Any questions for Mazin? Thank you. And it looks like our first panel is already here. Gentlemen.
For the record, Brian DeLeishman, representing the Community Providers Association of Oregon. I have with me Dave Zabak, the president. We'll each do a very brief Friday afternoon, sunny. Instructions are keep it short. Even though we've got lots of time until 3 o'clock now, we won't take much time. Just a little background on this first. During last session, it became very apparent to myself and my clients that the developmentally disabled population in Oregon was going to be very negatively impacted by budget reductions. And so to give you a little history, October of 11, the provider groups in the state of Oregon for developmentally disabled took a 6% reduction in the provider rates. They were scheduled for another 4% reduction coming in October, this past October. So, excuse me, the 6% was prior to that. We were able to, through the generosity of the legislature and some Ways and Means folks that work very hard, to get some money that kind of tided us over until April 1st of this year to allow us some time to work on some alternatives to try and shore up DD, provider reimbursement. So with that, we kind of had the brainchild of, well, let's figure out if we can kind of model ourselves the same way as the hospital tax we've established in the state. We also have an insurance tax. When you leverage that with the federal dollars, you bring it back, you're generating more dollars and you're mitigating the cuts. So I guess with that, I'd indicate that if you don't like this idea, you can blame me because it came to me during last session. It's kind of snowballed since then. We've got a lot of people that are interested in this. The voluntary assessment contained in 4036 obviously is an effort to mitigate that additional 4% reduction. It doesn't mitigate the entire 4% reduction. When you take 1% as outlined in the tax and you match it with federal dollars, we get 1.6 back. So we're really only reducing the exposure of the reduction by 1.6% of the 4%. So it helps a little bit. Is this an ideal option? And you will hear probably from others, or if not, the division is here to explain. And I know your staff has a fact sheet that looks a little like this that explains why we chose this particular tax. Well, it was pretty much the only option we had. If we had other options, we may have suggested an entirely new tax at a higher rate to get a higher federal match. But Legislative Council last session indicated when asked about the options that will allow us to get the federal match, that this is pretty much our only option of an existing tax that's broad-based that we can use that fits the definition under the federal statutes. So here we are. I'll conclude. In short, what we're asking you, the DDIC community is asking you to do is we'd like to help you, help us, help our clients. And with that, I've got one closing additional comment. I mean, obviously, there's been some feedback to me and others. Do we really want to do this? Because it's a tax that's going to be in place. And how do we know that, in fact, the money's going to go to where it needs to go? Ultimately, the same way with the hospital tax, we would need at the end of this process some kind of a letter of understanding that this money, if imposed on these providers, are going to go back to these providers and that it doesn't get siphoned off to other programs, or that the money that's used here to offset that 4% reduction doesn't then get used or pulled from behind us in another way. So with that, I'll close and let Dave make his comments.
Thank you, Brian. My name is Dave Zabak, and I'm the Executive Director at Home Life, and we're a nonprofit residential and vocational provider for adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities in Corvallis, Benton County. I'm also here representing, I'm the president of our Community Providers Association of Oregon. That's an association of 18 provider agencies, much like Home Life, around the state of Oregon. And we're in favor of House Bill 4036, both myself and this Community Providers Association. Like Brian said, in October, this last October, our funding was cut 6%, and in April, we'll be cut an additional 4% for a total of 10% to our state revenues. This has forced Home Life to cut 10 positions or 7 full-time equivalents. This has put an incredible strain on the remaining staff to continue the level of care that our clients require. This creates additional stress in an environment that can already be stressful for both clients and staff. My fellow provider agencies have also cut positions. They've had to water down their health care benefits, freeze wages, and in some cases even close some of their facilities, I think vocational facilities. Some providers have had to make the tough decision to not take some of the highest need clients because with the staffing levels as low as they are, they just can't provide a safe place for those people. I've worked in Oregon supporting people with intellectual and developmental disabilities for 22 years now. And my sister-in-law is a person with disabilities. She lives in a group home that's also been affected by these cuts, not our agency, a different agency. But our clients and their families rely on us to provide safe and community-integrated care. The budget crisis and the corresponding staff cuts are the worst I've seen. I'm concerned for our clients and staff. With less staff, clients tend to spend more time in the group homes, which creates some isolation and the potential for more behavioral problems. This voluntary assessment that's proposed in House Bill 4036 will provide some relief to these cuts. It's estimated that it would reduce our cuts in April from 4% to 2.4%. And at Home Life, that would be the equivalent of 2 full-time staff positions, people that we can put back to work and relieve the stress on our clients and staff. So although it's a relatively small amount, the benefit would outweigh the administrative hassle of doing the tax. I also believe that this new revenue source would help us squeak by until the economy recovers. So I think every little bit's going to help us get through this time. So thank you, and please support this bill.
We welcome any questions, and you heard the term voluntary assessment. We don't view this as a tax. We view this as a voluntary assessment. Again, we're putting some money forward to try and get the federal match.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
We appreciate it.
Beverly Heron, Tim Krall, Joanne Furman.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Honorable co-chairs and committee members, my name is Beverly Heron. I live in Salem, Oregon, and I'm the executive director of Resource Connections of Oregon, one of 13 support service brokerages in the state. The 13 support service brokerages have joined together and developed our own association, Oregon Support Services Association. You will see attached to my testimony, written testimony, which I am very pleased to present on behalf of OSSA. OSSA and our specifically Resource Connections of Oregon are very supportive of this House bill. To highlight what is in the written testimony, I would like to point out that there is that much-needed sunset provision, which will allow the legislation to be reviewed in a few years to ensure that it's either needed or not needed, or some other source of revenue has been developed. Since it's important to note that since October of 2010, support service brokerages have already taken nearly 20% cuts in our administrative budgets. In April of this year, we are expected to take another 7% of cuts. It is absolutely devastating to talk to staff, to let them know that their jobs may be on the line, and then to actually have to terminate employees who are doing the work because they believe in it, they want to serve their communities, and this tax will be a way to hopefully help save those jobs. Support services is just one important part of the collective services that are in the state of Oregon. This tax will help all of us. We need a cohesive system to ensure that we have cost-effective and efficient services. Thank you very much, and I'll answer questions if you have them.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Tim Krall, and I'm executive director of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. We're a nonprofit association that's been around 45 years, representing nonprofits who provide jobs and homes to people in the community with disabilities. I worked with Brian and others with the co-chairs of the Human Resources Sub last session on this concept, and Representative Kotek actually did get the bill introduced, but it was too late to push through the session. So we're very thankful to the committee for introducing this bill. I would support everything that Brian mentioned. Our membership is across the state. We serve about 6,000 people with disabilities in communities all over the state. Shangri-La, Albertina Kerr, Tualatin Valley Workshop, Whitco, all of you have members that deliver these services in your home communities. And I'd simply like to note before our legislative chair talks about the individual impact is that this bill does have the support of the entire developmental disabilities community, the Mental Health Directors Association, the case managers, the community DD program providers, as Bev said, the OSSA, the Oregon DD Council, and the Oregon Coalition. And we will do everything we can to help ensure its passage. Thank you.
Well, co-chairs and members of the committee, thank you for your time today. My name is Joanne Furman, and I'm the director and co-founder of Partnerships in Community Living. PCL is a nonprofit organization that originated in Polk County in 1986 to meet the needs of people with developmental disabilities and intellectual disabilities leaving Fairview Training Center. 25 years later, we provide services to over 160 individuals in comprehensive service and 75 individuals and families through the brokerage systems in 7 counties throughout Oregon. Our dedicated employees help the people we serve live safe, quality lives by supporting them in their homes. We help them make meaningful contributions to their community through employment and community integration activities. And many of the people we serve are formal residents of Fairview Training Center. And when they came to our services, they had labels such as difficult and aggressive and medically fragile. And these same individuals have lived successfully in our communities for 25 years. These services we provide allow Oregonians and our vulnerable citizens to have the right to a life that is safe while valuing their gifts and contributions in a responsible and cost-effective manner. Our services, like others statewide, have suffered serious cutbacks over the last 2 years. For PCL, this has meant $128,000 per month in losses. And those losses were devastating, especially when you consider the rising cost of doing providing services and employing people. So, you know, our employees from top down have taken reductions in wages and benefits. We're operating under a wage freeze with no end in sight. We've had to close two businesses that provided job training. We have cut our administrative supports and our support positions to bare bones. And even with all those painful reductions, we still had to reduce over 4,500 hours per month of direct service to the people we serve, which is about 25 FTE. And that's very significant. You would consider these are the roles of people who are helping people sort of live their life and keep them safe. We have minimal staffing patterns right now that really, I don't see that we have anywhere else to cut without really seriously jeopardizing the health and safety of the people we're charged by our mission and our contract to protect. I'm really proud of the focus and values of our employees, and many of them have made personal sacrifices to put those we serve first. However, all these cuts have not meant less work or less need. And I fear that our very dedicated employees will not be able to endure yet another devastating blow to the structure that supports the work they do. I mean, really, people are tired. They've been working hard and tired. And so when I tell them we're facing more cuts, it's hard to keep their morale going and people looking to the future. While implementing these reductions, we've also worked closely with OR membership statewide and the DD office to do things that we figure out ways we can absorb and be more efficient with the work we do. We continue to work towards improvements, developing new service models, technological supports that keep people healthy and safe while still reducing cost. But human beings with severe physical and mental challenges need well-trained, consistent human support 24 hours a day and often for the rest of their lives. We now face more cuts in April that will mean another 50 for PCL, another 55,000 per month in reductions. Among my peers, I'm usually the one who's sort of cheerleading and saying, I'm sure we can work this out. But this time, I'm here to tell you I'm at a loss for how we can realistically take these cuts and survive. My heart breaks when I watch the organization I founded and the possibility of failing the people we support, their communities, and our employees. If the nonprofit sector cannot afford to support these vulnerable people, who will support them? And ultimately, the state will be required to support them, but at a cost that's far above the rates we receive, but not to mention the real cost, the human cost of people losing their homes, their communities, and their friends. We urge you to support this bill. It's essential to our survival. Thank you, and if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you very much. Very eloquent. Yes, Representative Gillis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to thank you all for coming today and just to take a moment to thank you for really creating a system of services that is something Oregon can really be deeply proud of. I'm lucky enough to get to travel and spend a lot of time with people in the disability community across the United States. And what I always hear is how ahead of the curve Oregon is and how that came to be because of the values of the people that make it work. And those are everyone from our seniors and people with disabilities offices to our nonprofit partners. I think one of the areas that people are most interested in is our brokerage system and how that is uniquely able to support people to continue to live in the community in less expensive programs. And I'm wondering, as you're talking about the need for these resources, there was a lawsuit filed, I think, last week that has to do with employment of people in segregated settings. Can you tell me a little bit about the role that the brokerage plays in doing employment planning and placement for people that was spoken about and your ability to meet that need without the additional resources that this bill would provide?
Thank you, Representative Gelser and members of the committee. One of the marvels of the support service brokerages and one of the reasons it is so effective is that we develop plans based on what individuals need, and we don't give all people everything. People get what they need. Often people want to have employment. They want to have jobs in the community. They want to be a part of the workforce. To access a job in the community, we call supported employment. A lot of people do need ongoing supports. We have to go to voc rehab first to access their services before we can use brokerage services. It takes a tremendous amount of effort and energy and coordination between our services and voc rehab, incredible amount of time on the part of our personal agents, our frontline staff, in helping to coordinate the services between the brokerage and voc rehab. And voc rehab plays a wonderful role. It's just that our missions don't exactly mesh. And people can be waiting for voc rehab services for years, literally, and go into the system, not be successful, be closed out, try to go back into the system, et cetera. With the advent of the latest lawsuit, you know, we are not sure how it's going to go. We're looking at it. We are estimating that our jobs will, the personal agent's jobs, will increase in terms of being able to find additional resources, working through VR, hopefully looking at the system, developing other partnerships. So we will not only have personal agents doing more work, it's slightly different than the work that they're currently doing, so they will need additional training. And it's all to ensure that people are a part of the workforce that they want to be. Does that answer your question?
It does, and I think the clarification that I was looking for, you are going to be asked to and required to do that work despite facing a $600,000 reduction that puts you to a 27% reduction in this triennium.
Correct, yes, in a nutshell. Thank you.
And this tax would help you, this assessment would help you get to that place. Thank you.
Representative Pence?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Questions I'm going to ask have nothing to do with the quality of the work you're providing and have everything to do with convincing folks that you actually need more money. One of the missing elements of many of these hearings are the specific amounts that people are being paid. Many times that all we see is not-for-profit, or we'll see took a cut or bare bones. That's all very fine, but it assumes a standard. And we don't have that luxury anymore. You have to show us. We have to see what it is that people are getting paid, and you have to give us some sort of numbers. It has to be like most of the people make minimum wage. Most of the people have no health care that work for us. Most of the people don't have a retirement. Most of the people don't get vacation. Those kinds of specific things are what people ask me when I go home, and I have to respond. And when they say, gee, Vince, you voted for another handout from the federal government. I need something. You need to arm me with something. I know about the need. I've had numerous of my constituents come to me about your programs and ask that I vote for this tax. It's not the tax that's the problem. It's asking for that federal money. So I need those specifics. Okay, they're not here. And I'm not in any way trying to suggest that you're overpaid, but we're not allowed to make that assumption. So can you get me that material?
Representative Pence, co-chairs, members of the committee, Tim Krall. Yes, we can provide you with statistics on average wages, benefits, et cetera. We're not at minimum wage, and the jobs that we employ people to do are not minimum wage jobs. We're not very far above it, though. I think our average starting salary is now around $9 an hour. Mm-hmm. Most organizations have health care, but the employees have to contribute. I can give you all this stuff written down. They contribute to their health care.
Please.
I want it written down.
I
don't need it today.
Okay.
I'm just telling you what I need when I go home. So.
Got it. Okay, we'll be happy to provide that.
And I would add one thing to that, and that is the sort of credentials that you expect for the people at the various wage levels. That you indicated these are not minimum wage jobs, and I assume what you mean by that is that people require some skill and training and educational background in order to do the work.
And training, exactly, Representative.
And Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
I think another piece
Gelser.
Of information, thank you, Mr. Chair, that would be helpful in that information is, of course, this is about the workers that work there, but ultimately it's about the safety and the quality of life of the individuals that your employees are serving. So maybe you could also talk about the rate of turnover of your employees there and the way that impacts quality of life and safety of the clients that you're serving.
As well as, thank you, Representative Gilser, as well as the kinds of required staffing ratios that we need, which is where, most of our expenses are in people, and that's what we'll show you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Berger?
If I could take this opportunity, because Joanne Furman is right in front of me. Polk Community Living, or Partnerships in Community
it's
Living,
okay,
it used to be Polk, is in the Monmouth Independence, it's in other areas, but it's centered in Monmouth Independence area of my district. And I guess I want to say, for the committee's benefit, and for particularly for Joanne's, because she's in front of me, is that when we closed down Fairview and this population was moved out, there was a lot of angst about having them in the community. Monmouth and Independence are not big communities. And the integration with this program and the population, I've visited the homes, you talk to people on the street, it's a wonderful thing to have a small community embrace this population, and it's a credit to the provider. It's a credit to her and the people that work with her, that the community embraces them as much as they are part of it. And that is such a huge thing for all concerned. So I'm taking this up to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I do note, too, that in the list of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association on that page, someone has written in hand, on my copy at least, the locations of some of the sites that you cited. And I noted, Representative Bentz, that one of them is in Ontario and one of them is in Eugene. and they're scattered around various other places as well. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you for your time.
Ralph Groner, Jessica Stevens, Bob Jundin.
Madam and Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, respectfully, my name is Ralph Groner for the record. I represent American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and I do represent in the private sector Albertina Kerr, Coast Rehab, Star of Hope, anyway, a number of private, we also are the state, separate issue. They're the 90% or small prisons now, according to my staff, and they're no longer what they were. Private sector, just quickly, I've always wanted revenue and ways and means to hear things together for about 40 years now, and this is why. All of this history has come in front of ways and means. We all worked for years. We, meaning a wonderful organization, myself, in behalf of salary and benefits for the employees. So ways and means has hurt it because we had turnover as high as 100% at one time to keep an employee when they could go to McDonald's rather than work here. So we've improved that my union strongly supports management of these facilities. I want you to know we're together on this. I was surprised with the quote they made to me when I talked to them. They weren't so concerned about themselves as the client. That might shock you. So many of these folks who are working in these facilities, again, we have Albertina Kerr in your section and here in Salem as well as Eugene, but we also have other group private sector group homes. So my only comment is that if we have this kind of reduction in revenue when we have all worked very hard over many, many years to try to make the employees remain there in behalf of the client, the fact of the matter is this shoves it back further, and my members' concern is the quality of care for the client. If people are laid off further, that means you put a disproportionate burden dealing with the developmental disability population. So we're not being self-serving. We just have a very, very wonderful group of people to work with. My members thoroughly care about their jobs, of course, but they care about the client and they care about this issue and wanted me to tell you we strongly exhort you to please pass this measure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. and Madam Chair, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. Disability Rights Oregon is the federally funded protection advocacy organization for people with disabilities across the state. We've been operating since 1977, and we've been members of the DD Coalition since its inception, and I don't exactly remember that date. What I'm here today is to urge passage of this bill. In our view, Oregon has one of the most fiscally efficient and service efficient systems for folks with developmental disabilities in the nation. It's something we can be proud of. In our last session, we wrote the into statute the brokerage system, which had been developed as a result of a lawsuit back in the year 2000. And people were skeptical about doing that. They were concerned that this might be an entitlement, that we might be building new bureaucratic systems when the budget is in danger. But in fact, what the committee learned at that time and what you learned at that time was that we have a system that is incredibly efficient, that gives services to people who need them. There is no entitlement amount. It's targeted. Families step up and work in collaboration with the brokerages in order to get the right services to the right people. And so this is a lean system. It always has been a lean system. It's designed to be so. And even though the bill before you would not generate enormous amounts of revenue, it will be able to keep us from going over a tipping point in which we'll have people spiraling off into more expensive services. So we urge your support.
Thank you.
Chairs Barnhart and Berger. My name is Jessica Stevens, and I'm here testifying on behalf of SEIU Local 503 in support of this bill. We represent about 9,000 in-home caregivers, adult foster care providers, and residential care providers who work with people with developmental disabilities. Many of the other folks here today have gone over a lot of the details, so we wanted to just make sure to be on the record in support of this effort. We really think it's important to take advantage of the federal funding that is available. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions, comments for this group? Representative Gelser? No? I wanted to add a comment that was sort of triggered for me by Representative Gelser's comment to the last panel, and that is that when I was here in 2001 to 2003, we had a severe budget crisis then, as some of you who were here then remember. And one of the things, I was serving on the Health Committee at that time, and one of the things that we did during that period to try to deal with the budget was that the Ways and Means Committee and the legislature cut a number of small nonprofit enterprises, cut budgets for state budgets for them in the mental health area. And they had to do with support for people with mental disorders in the community. And we were talking in many cases about very small amounts of money that were used for basic services that were pieced together with services from other agencies like HUD housing and sheltered employment and a variety of other things for those folks. And the result of the very small amounts that were cut, which were in many cases the entire budgets of these small nonprofits, from at least from the state support, was that the programs that had been very carefully stitched together unraveled very quickly. Our expenses, our cost to help deal with those people in different ways that were turned out to be much more expensive in the long run, and much less flexible and with much greater difficulty. I have to say that experience convinced me to appreciate the work that small nonprofits do in these areas where dealing with individuals in individual ways to deal with the individual issues that they have makes a whole lot of sense through very flexible nonprofits with people leading them who care a lot about the clients they're working with and who are committed to working with as many of those clients as they can manage because that's what you do. And when you talk about efficiencies, I believe you. I know the people who work in this area, at least not all of them, but by type, and that's exactly what they do. I'm hoping we can figure out ways to not do what we did in 2002 and 2003 when we cut those programs. Thank you, Representative Gelser.
Mr. Chair, you did trigger something, and I'm still thinking about Representative Bence's question for information, and this may be something from Bob or the DD Coalition or the Council. I think when we talk about the people that are already in the system that are able to access comprehensive services or that are able to access a placement in a group home or able to access support services brokerages, we are talking about that very fortunate minority of the population that has been able to get through the door, because we continue to reduce and tighten up the eligibility requirements for who it is that can receive assistance. So what you tend to find are the large numbers of families across the state of Oregon that are providing support and assistance to their adult children with intellectual and developmental disabilities without access to any supports whatsoever. And we have continued to see those reductions, including in the last session when we changed access to the brokerage system to people ages 18 to 21, to individuals who are not Medicaid eligible for a variety of reasons. So I think that information would be helpful as well. The number of people that are being turned away from service, the high bar that someone must reach in order to get a placement in comprehensive services. We receive those kinds of letters about the level of crisis that people must hit before they can receive help. I think that is important to understanding the system as well. When we closed Fairview, the nonprofit partners were very generous and have been good partners in stepping up to work with the state. I think it's important for the state to keep up its end of the bargain in providing sufficient resources, not only to allow the nonprofits to do their work, but to make sure that we aren't leaving behind individuals with developmental disabilities and their families to be able to participate in community life and care for the rest of their families, frankly.
Thank you, Representative. Other comments? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony very much. Now, I've reached the end of my list. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on this measure today? Thank you. And with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 4036, and we'll open the work session on House Bill 4047.
Yes, sir.
If it's a sin, it's Madden.
Oh, that's right.
Well, Chair Barnhart, I think this bill needs to be named Representative Berger's second bottle bill.
Second bottle bill.
And this,
you're in trouble now.
I second that.
For Carlos' humor. And this, just to refresh your memory, this was about the Capital Foundation issue to be able to raffle or sell spirits, liquor they're able to do with wine and beer at this time. And this bill allows them to, and other nonprofits, to engage in that behavior. So you heard this on the first day of February, and that's, you have it with no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Thank you. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4047 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves House Bill 4047 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? I would simply note that watching the meeting on Wednesday on the Internet, I wasn't comfortable. I'm sorry. Did I miss something? Someone? Oh, I thought someone else wanted to talk. I noted that the bottle that was in question was placed on the shiny top of the table out here, and I was not comfortable until she put it back in the box. Because I was afraid of it at that point. You can tell how I was feeling on Wednesday. Is there any further discussion? Is there any? Yes, Representative Berger.
Only thank you, committee members, for enjoying the story as much as I have, as it's been sort of ongoing, and you can understand how compelling it was to bring that bottle in here, set it up there.
Right.
And Jenny did a wonderful job of, because this is really her story.
Representative Berger.
May I ask a curious question?
Sure.
What is the approximate value of that bottle?
Well, we're talking thousands.
Wow. I can see your fear.
It is, after all, Kentucky bourbon whiskey, which
will never, in this millennium,
appear. It's a special...
Special thing.
Batch.
Yes. And I could tell more stories about that, but I won't. Is there any objection to the motion? The motion is to send this bill to the floor with a due pass. I don't see any objections. With that, the motion carries. Representative Berger, would you like to carry this bill?
I would be honored to.
I figured you might. Representative Berger will carry. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 4047. Cheers. Is there anything else to come before the committee today?
Cheers.
Take the next hour off, please. We will see you Monday at 3 o'clock.
Before the gavel goes down, can I just say to the committee members, senior property tax deferral, you have been stalwart. You have worked really hard. Speaking for my co-chair, thank you. We didn't know. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank
been
you.
Hard. It's been hard, and it isn't over, but we've managed to find some common ground here where, that we can work in.
We do have the amendment for the members of the committee, so you'll have a chance to study it over the weekend if you want to. We have that now.
We will electronically
get
it to us.
We'll get it to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else this afternoon? If not, I'll see you at 3 o'clock. Remember, strange schedule, 3 o'clock on Monday. And with that, the committee is adjourned.
Are we 3 o'clock every...